The mechanical revolution, the process of mechanical invention and discovery, was a new thing in human experience, and it went on regardless of the social, political, economic, and industrial consequences it might produce. The industrial revolution, on the other hand, like most other human affairs, was and is more and more profoundly changed and deflected by the constant variation in human conditions caused by the mechanical revolution. And the essential difference between the amassing of riches, the extinction of small farmers and small businessmen, and the phase of big finance in the latter centuries of the Roman Republic on the one hand, and the very similar concentration of capital in the 18th and 19th centuries on the other, lies in the profound difference in the character of labor that the mechanical revolution was bringing about. The power of the old world was human power. Everything depended ultimately upon the driving power of human muscle, the muscle of ignorant and subjugated men. A little animal muscle, supplied by draft oxen, horse traction, and the like, contributed. Where a weight had to be lifted, men lifted it. Where a rock had to be quarried, men chipped it out. Where a field had to be ploughed, men and oxen ploughed it. The Roman equivalent of the steamship was the galley, with its banks of sweating rowers. A vast proportion of mankind in the early civilizations was employed in purely mechanical drudgery. At its outset, power-driven machinery didn't seem to promise any release from such unintelligent toil. Great gangs of men were employed in excavating canals, in making railway cuttings and embankments and the like. The number of miners increased enormously, but the extension of facilities and the output of commodities increased much more. And as the 19th century went on, the plain logic of the new situation asserted itself more clearly. Human beings were no longer wanted as a source of mere indiscriminate power. What could be done mechanically by a human being could be done faster and better by a machine. The human being was needed now only where choice and intelligence had to be exercised. Human beings were wanted only as human beings. The drudge, on whom all the previous civilizations had rested, the creature of mere obedience, the man whose brains were superfluous, had become unnecessary to the welfare of mankind. This was as true of such ancient industries as agriculture and mining as it was of the newest metallurgical processes. For ploughing, sowing, and harvesting, swift machines came forward to do the work of scores of men. The Roman civilization was built upon cheap and degraded human beings. Modern civilization is being rebuilt upon cheap mechanical power. For 100 years, power has been getting cheaper and labor dearer. If for a generation or so machinery has had to wait its turn in the mine, it's simply because for a time men were cheaper than machinery. Now here was a changeover of quite primary importance in human affairs. The chief solicitude of the rich and of the ruler in the old civilization had been to keep up a supply of drudges. As the 19th century went on, it became more and more plain to the intelligent directive people that the common man had now to be something better than a drudge. He had to be educated, if only to secure industrial efficiency. He had to understand what he was about. From the days of the first Christian propaganda, popular education had been smoldering in Europe, just as it has smoldered in Asia, wherever Islam has set its foot, because of the necessity of making the believer understand a little of the belief by which he's saved, and of enabling him to read a little in the sacred books by which his belief is conveyed. Christian controversies, with their competition for adherents, plough to the ground for the harvest of popular education. In England, for instance, by the 30s and 40s of the 19th century, the disputes of the sects and the necessity of catching adherents young had produced an abundance of night schools, Sunday schools, and a series of competing educational organizations for children, the dissenting British schools, the church national schools, and even Roman Catholic elementary schools. The earlier, less enlightened manufacturers, unable to take a broad view of their own interests, hated and opposed these schools. But here again, needy Germany led her richer neighbors. The religious teacher in Britain presently found the profit-seeker at his side, unexpectedly eager to get the commonalty, if not educated, at least trained, to a higher level of economic efficiency. The second half of the 19th century was a period of rapid advance in popular education throughout all the westernized world. There was no parallel advance in the education of the upper classes. Some advance, no doubt, but nothing to correspond. And so the great gulf that had divided that world hitherto into the readers and the non-reading mass became little more than a slight perceptible difference in educational level. At the back of this process was the mechanical revolution, apparently regardless of social conditions, but really insisting inexorably upon the complete abolition of a totally illiterate class throughout the world. The economic revolution of the Roman Republic had never been clearly apprehended by the common people of Rome. The ordinary Roman citizen never saw the changes through which he lived clearly and comprehensively as we see them. But the industrial revolution, as it went on towards the end of the 19th century, was more and more distinctly seen as one whole process by the common people it was affecting, because presently they could read and discuss and communicate, and because they went about and saw things as no commonalty had ever done before. In this outline of history, we've been careful to indicate the gradual appearance of the ordinary people as a class with a will and ideas in common. It's the writer's belief that massive movements of the ordinary people over considerable areas only became possible as a result of the propagandist religions, Christianity and Islam, and their insistence upon individual self-respect. We've cited the enthusiasm of the commonalty for the First Crusade as marking a new phase in social history. But before the 19th century, even these massive movements were comparatively restricted. The equalitarian insurrections of the peasantry from the Wycliffe period onward were confined to the peasant communities of definite localities. They spread only slowly into districts affected by similar forces. The town artisan rioted indeed, but only locally. The chateau burning of the French Revolution wasn't the act of a peasantry who had overthrown a government. It was the act of a peasantry released by the overthrow of a government. The Commune of Paris was the first effective appearance of the town artisan as a political power, and the Parisian crowd of the First Revolution was a very mixed, primitive-thinking and savage crowd compared with any Western European crowd after 1830. But the mechanical revolution wasn't only pressing education upon the whole population. It was leading to a big capitalism and to a large-scale reorganization of industry that was to produce a new and distinctive system of ideas in the common people, in the place of the mere uncomfortable recalcitrance and elemental rebellions of an illiterate commonalty. We've already noted how the Industrial Revolution had split the manufacturing class, which had hitherto been a middling and various sort of class, into two sections, the employers, who became rich enough to mingle with the financial, merchandising, and landowning classes, and the employees, who drifted to a status closer and closer to that of mere gang and agricultural labor. As the manufacturing employees sank, the agricultural laborer, by the introduction of agricultural machinery and the increase in his individual productivity, rose.